The meeting of the Senate Finance Committee will please come to order. For the record, it is Thursday, February 23rd, 2012. And we have four bills on the agenda this morning, and our first bill is Senate File 1586, and Senator Limmer is the author. Welcome, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1586 regards a new crime called vulnerable adult felony deprivation. You may have seen this bill listed earlier as an intentional felony neglect of vulnerable adults, but different parties that are interested in this particular legislation thought that that might be going in slightly the wrong direction, and so we've done a lot of work with all of the parties that have an interest in this. Negotiations that developed as a result of the first bill actually was a very positive experience. All of the parties are now in agreement with the bill, but I would like to have representatives from Hennepin County Prosecutor's Office to describe the technical details that we now have arrived at and that is reflected in the bill now itself. I have Amy Sweezy from Hennepin County and Dave Brown from Hennepin County Prosecutor's Office that would like to give a quick review of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Ms. Sweezy, did you want to start?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. What we do have here is the compromise, as Senator Limmer said, for what is essentially a new crime. It will be in with what is now the gross misdemeanor crime of neglect of a vulnerable adult. The felony crime is titled deprivation. And what we have are elements that are different and more difficult to prove, frankly, than the gross misdemeanor crime. It requires the intentional deprivation by a caregiver of food, clothing, shelter, health care, or supervision. And then there are two theories, separate theories, under which charges can be brought here. The first is that the caregiver knew or had reason to know that depriving the vulnerable adult of whatever it is that we're talking about could likely have resulted in harm to the vulnerable adult. The second theory is that a prosecutor would prove that the deprivation occurred over an extended period of time. And the extended period of time language, frankly, is borrowed from the child neglect and criminal sexual conduct statutes. So that's where that came from. There are exemptions already in the law, in the gross misdemeanor law that we left untouched. And those involve actions taking place by a caregiver that have to do with the vulnerable adult's right to make medical decisions, enter into a medical directive, and pre-existing consensual relationships between the parties. The penalties that exist in the new bill are a 10-year penalty for the infliction of great bodily harm as a result of the deprivation, and a 5-year penalty for substantial bodily harm as a result of the deprivation. Those are concepts taken well established in the Minnesota Criminal Code already, most notably the assault statutes. The last part of it are the three affirmative defenses, and this is the part that the group spent the most amount of time working on in our negotiations. What we meant to do here is spell out three types of scenarios that ought to be excluded from charges, and these are the areas. The first is to provide an affirmative defense for workers basically in facilities, group homes, and the like. And they will have a defense if they can show that they were unable to make the accommodation to provide the care that they were supposed to provide because of understaffing, inadequate supervision, or the institutional policies of the place where they work, basically. So if something very bad happens and the worker is in a situation where they were unable to provide the care, that would be something that would be a defense to them. The second is basically the flip side. That is for the operators of the facilities, and basically that is an affirmative defense meant to protect the facility from charges in the case of an intentional act by an employee that the provider could not have known about. So essentially the lone actor scenario. So that's meant to provide an otherwise well-operated and run facility from being brought to charges under those circumstances. And the third affirmative defense is something that we talked about at extreme length, what we call the two call lights on at once scenario. What is a caregiver to do when two vulnerable adults need care at the same time? And the affirmative defense that we've created here in this bill is to provide that if the employee can show that he or she necessarily needed to be providing care to another person at the same time, they would be that would be a scenario that would be excluded from charges. We thought it was important to spell out these three factual scenarios as affirmative defenses in the bill itself, because while it is not technically a new crime, this whole new statute would be something that would be available to police and prosecutors at the time the case is being investigated and at the before charges are brought. And in that sense, it would have everybody thinking ahead of time, we believe, about these three factual scenarios to make sure that when we are issuing charges, we're issuing them on the right party and the person who's actually guilty of this new crime.
Thank you, Ms. Sweezy. Does anyone have any questions? Mr. Brown, did you want to make some comments?
Madam Chair, just briefly, I'm David Brown. I'm also an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I just wanted to say a brief word of thanks to Senator Limmer for helping bring this group together and to let the committee know what an enormous amount of work went into putting the language together that you see in front of you. A number of care provider organizations worked diligently, a number of representatives of the care workers, of family members, people that advocate on behalf of vulnerable adults, all sat down in a room and put and worked very hard to put together what you see in front of you. So thank you very much.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, just so you're aware, for a number of, as has been alluded, there has been a number of organizations that are involved in this, law enforcement, senior citizens, disability associations. And if I could just read some of them into the record so the committee is comfortable. Minnesota County Attorneys Association, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, Center for Elder and Justice and Policy, ARP, Tubman Elder Care Rights Center, Minnesota Board of Aging, Area Agencies on Aging, the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care, Ombudsman for Mental Health and Development Disabilities, the Disability Law Center, and St. Thomas Law School Senior Clinic faculty and students. Have all had a little bit of a piece of this, and it's a broad involvement in this particular policy. If you'd like to get into more of the details on the financing element, we do have my staff for the finance area, and we could bring them up to the table.
And that's why you're here, Senator Limmer. We will be talking about the financing in a second, but Senator Hand, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Limmer, you may have address this in the bill, but just for purposes of clarification, in the circumstance where you have someone in a hospital situation, maybe in a coma, and I think there have been instances nationally of decisions made to deprive food or water, does this bill cover those circumstances and make that a felony when under those circumstances?
Senator Limmer.
Senator Hand, I'm going to allow one of the attorneys to give you a review of that.
Ms. Sweezy?
Madam Chair, Senator, no, it would not make that. It would not criminalize the conduct provided that it is a product of a medical decision or a medical directive. The law as it exists now, with the only penalty being the gross misdemeanor, provides for decisions to be made for patients by themselves and their doctors. So, no, that wouldn't be criminal conduct.
And, Madam
Senator
Chair, so if there is no medical directive, and a physician in a hospital decides to deprive food or water to a person in a coma, that is not a felony under this law.
Ms. Sweezy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I guess it would depend on what the physician's reason was for acting. If it is part of the care plan and part of the patient's plan of care, but theoretically, you could have a situation where a doctor, just like any worker, could make a decision on their own to deprive somebody for an improper purpose, for the purpose of causing that sort of harm only. And then theoretically, yes, that there's nothing that would exclude physicians per se from this. But also, the law is not meant to criminalize reasonable choices related to medical care.
Well, and Madam Chair, that's kind of what I'm trying to understand is there have been cases and even advocates for the idea that under certain circumstances, it is preferable in some medical person's view to allow a person in a certain state to die and to do that by depriving food or water. And I'm just trying to understand if that's considered care or is that considered an act that would be criminal under this law. In other words, is euthanasia under the circumstance of a person being unable to be responsive, not having a health care directive, and a physician or a physician team deciding that it's better off for that person to die, and that decision were made, would that be a felony under this law?
Ms. Sweezy.
Madam Chair, Senator, no, I don't believe so. This that would be covered under the medical decisions exemption, which is simply conduct that's not criminalized. But as I said, a hypothetical, I mean, I can imagine a scenario where we would not be in that situation, but it's hard to say particularly what sort of conduct what kind of evidence I would need to prove that somebody was intentionally depriving for the purpose of causing harm versus an appropriate medical decision. That certainly, I want to be clear, is not meant to be criminalized.
And Madam Chair, that's what I'm trying to get clarification on. If the, as has been the case, I believe, in some instances, where the decision has been made that it is preferable to allow the patient to die, and that is the, quote, medical decision, and that would be permissible under this law. Is that correct?
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that's actually outside the scope of this law. What you're talking about there is something that talks about court orders being allowed to do that. I don't believe that's at all covered by the criminalization of intentional neglect here. Our law has an exemption for medical decisions and particularly medical directives, and actually spells out some of the scenarios where Minnesota's already taking care of that. But what you're talking about, I think, is outside the scope of this particular bill.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Related to this, I've had some contact from various individuals and had some information from other individuals who are very well connected high up with some indication that there may be some, at least there's some hints that there may be some implementation of futility policies at some locations, which is, I think, maybe what Senator Hanna is talking about. And if you're not familiar with a futility policy, I can explain that, but is that something that would be outside the scope of this as well? Is it would not touch on that? Or would it fall within that scope? Futility policy essentially is they're not worth spending the money on. And oftentimes it falls under those who are in public programs that are money losers. And for example, you might have an adult. There was a case here actually in Ramsey County sometime back where there was a very old elderly person, and they were on a public program, a county program, I think, and the county actually went to court saying we shouldn't have to take care of these medical costs, and the court said, yes, you do. You don't get to make that call. There are also some circumstances here locally with AIDS patients where care was not necessarily wanted to be provided because they were very terminal at that time, and that was corrected. In the new iterations, we may see something like what Senator Hamm was talking about, elderly adults, and or in the cases that have been brought, the potential scenarios that have been brought to my office related to very young children who had diseases that you wouldn't normally live very long, but maybe you could, those kinds of things. Would this touch on any of that, or is that completely outside the scope of what we're talking about here?
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, Senator Nino, this is this is a very narrow focus in the bill regarding this area of law. It does nothing to change the existing law that's already written regarding all of these other hypotheticals that you and Senator Hahn are delving into. The discussion in the Judiciary Committee didn't go in that direction at all. It's focused. It was originally brought to us based on the desire to address the intentional, what we think is criminal neglect of a vulnerable adult. These are people that are sometimes have mental disabilities. Certainly, the aged people who are rather feeble. These are people that we have begun to see a rise in incidences where individuals in the supposed care and treatment of them are sometimes neglected in their beds, neglected in their homes, to the point that it becomes an abusive relationship because of the lack of care, the deprivation of food and water, because the care workers or even some family members may just ignore the responsibility that they have assumed. We've seen photographs of in homes where trash, garbage, animal, and human excrement are piled up around the bed of an individual. That's the focus of what this bill is. And the other issues this bill does not go into at all.
Thank you, Senator Limmer, for that explanation. I would like to move on to the fiscal note. And we have one in our packet, members. There is an indication that there is some fiscal impact, mainly because we are making this a felony and there may be some additional prison time for individuals who would be found guilty of this new crime. So perhaps we could have an explanation of that from our...
Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce Chris Turner,
from our Senate
fiscal
Council.
Analyst with the Judiciary Committee.
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, members, what you should have in your packet is a fiscal note, Senate File 1586-0. The bill is introduced, and it's dated 2-1-12. And what you also have is a revised sentencing guidelines estimate dated February 21st, 2012, fiscal note for Senate File 1586-1E. We'll be working off the original fiscal note because the first engrossment in committee, what we did is added, or what the committee did was add affirmative defenses to the bill, so it did not increase the estimate, the offender estimate at all. So your fiscal note that you've got is current, even though it's for the bill as introduced. What the guidelines estimated is within the first year of implementation, they estimated one correctional bed, two in the second, and then three in the third and subsequent. And it comes out to $10,000 the first year, $26,000, and then $43,000. That would be the marginal cost of incarcerating a prisoner at the Department of Corrections. That is, the Department of Corrections has, you know, approximately 9,500 inmates. They project their population, and if they stay within 50 to 75 beds on either side of that, we generally don't appropriate money. That's within about a half to 1% of population, and this does not rise to the threshold where it would warrant an appropriation. The Department of Corrections would like to show that, you know, there is an amount of effort, shall we say. There is a cost. There will be some inmates, but it doesn't rise to the level where we would actually appropriate money.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. I just want to point out, and I think this is interesting for members to note, that in fiscal year 13, the average per diem for a prison bed is $44.19, and then it's projected to go to $44.36. It's pretty much flat, $44.54 for the 2015. So that's what we're looking at as a cost. And as Mr. Turner points out, there are 9,500 beds currently available within the system. And we also have heard good news in recent days or years that the crime rate has dropped fairly significantly. So we're hoping that there is some capacity in those prisons right now as less felons are being placed there. The serious crime rate anyway, not the overall crime rate, but the felony level crimes. So, Senator Hand, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, no, just if you're ready, I'd be willing to offer a motion. So, whenever
Chair.
You're ready.
Senator Higgins? Can I repair a couple of grammar and punctuation things?
This might be a good time to do that.
Okay. Madam Chair, see, I'm not on Senator Limmer's committee, so I don't get a chance to do this anymore. Line 1.16, after the word provisions, throw in a comma. There's one at the beginning of the phrase and none at the end of the phrase. So it just set it off. It needs one on both sides. And then on 2.32, delete due to and insert because of. And there's some, if you want me to go into grammar lessons, I can tell you the difference. But
could you
because
repeat
of is the correct phrase we should be using.
What line is it?
2.32.
Is our Senate counsel paying attention to just to make sure that there's no change in what it means? Are there any comments on those amendments? If not, we'll vote on Senator Higgins' amendments on line 2.32 and 1.16. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate File 1586 be recommended, pass, and referred to the floor.
Amended.
On that motion.
As amended.
As amended.
As amended. I forgot to ask for general testimony, and I don't know if anyone is here to testify, but we are particularly interested in the fiscal impact. So if there's someone here who would like to comment on that. Otherwise, Senator Hand renews his motion that Senate File 1586 be recommended to pass and placed on general orders. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders. Thank you, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee, and especially Senator Higgins for correcting our errors.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. I know this was a bill that was a work in progress for some time, and I'm glad that you were able to come to the table with consensus.
Yeah, I am too.
Our next bill on the agenda is Senator Rosen's bill. Senate File 1713.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. It's nice to be in front of your committee. Madam Chair and members, I have Senate File 1713, which is the Immigrant Minority Farmer Microloan Pilot Program. And the purpose of it right now is to create a new tool within the Rural Finance Authority to assist immigrant and minority farmers with small short-term microloans. And, Madam Chair, members, it just goes to show if you whine enough, you get what you want, because I wanted a good ag bill. And so Senator Magnus and the department gave me this bill. Whining does work. So basically, I'm here before you because this pilot program would allow these immigrant minority farmers the ability to establish some credit and to make a profit and build a business. And so this would give them some capital, a loan that they would have to pay back for equipment and supplies and whatever they need. And it would be for specialty crops and special animal production also. we're here in front of you because of the finance of it, and it's through we're actually eliminating the agroforestry loan program, transferring that into the total part of the rural finance authority's revolving loan account. So that account would not only include this immigrant minority loan program, it also would have the agroforestry loans and the value-added product loans, the livestock equipment loans, the methane digester loans, and the disaster recovery loans. There's approximately $262,000 in this account to date, and that was started. This account was actually started back in 2000 with $200,000, and now with interest, it's up to $262,000. So we're basically eliminating the agroforestry loan program because there has only been one application to that program in a separate account since 2000, and we're putting it into a total account with all these other loan programs. Let's see what else. The intermediary institutions would secure the training for the loan recipients and set the loan terms. And with that, Madam Chair, I have Greta Gathier from the department who can fill in the blanks.
Ms. Gap?
Gathier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gathier.
Gathier?
Gathier. Greta Gathier, Department of Agriculture. Yes, as Senator Rosen said, what we're doing here is creating a new tool in the Rural Finance Authority to assist a small but growing group of farmers in Minnesota that are immigrant and minority farmers. And we would take the current amount of money in the agroforestry loan account and move it into the general revolving account so that it would be accessible still for agroforestry loans, but also for these immigrant farmer loans and the other loans that Senator Rosen mentioned, the disaster loans and the livestock equipment loans, methane digester, et cetera. The Rural Finance Authority, just for background, was set up in the late 1980s after the farm crisis of the early 80s as a tool to help to provide revolving loans to help farmers with, at the time, initially restructuring and regaining their business. And over time, other tools have been added as needed. This is all a revolving loan. It is all paid back to the state with interest.
Ms. Gathier, where did the money originally come from that went into the agroforestry fund?
Madam Chair, that was an appropriation by the legislature in 2000. It was a general fund appropriation of $200,000, but it was part of the 2000 bonding bill. Even though it was a general fund appropriation, it was rolled into the bonding bill in the year 2000.
So at some point, will it expire or will it be forevermore a revolving loan fund?
Madam Chair, the way the language was, I believe, in 2000, it set this up as only a revolving loan fund only for agroforestry production operations. So since 2000, the department had one application for such a loan in 2003, and it has since obviously been paid back in full, and no other applications since 2003. And so there's a need there with immigrant and minority farmers, and this money is, yes, would be sitting there in perpetuity. So we would like to take it from that one dedicated account and move it into the account for all the revolving loan programs in the Rural Finance Authority that are listed. Those are all listed on the second page there of the, page three of the fiscal note.
Ms. Gathier, what is the interest rate normally on these loans?
Madam Chair, on the loan from 2003, I'm sorry, I don't have that data with me today. Generally, how we work with Rural Finance Authority is that the Department of Ag will partner with local lenders, and a portion of the loan will come from this fund, a portion will come through the local lender, and through that, the interest rate is able to be lower than it otherwise would be. But I can get you the amount of interest that was part of that loan agreement in 2003.
Senator Rosen, you mentioned that this was for specialty animals and crops. What is meant by that? Is it something that's out of the norm that a farmer would be raising?
Madam Chair, on page 5, line 1, the specialty crops as listed in the bill means agricultural crops, annual flowers, perennials, and other horticultural products that are intensively cultivated. And eligible livestock means poultry that has been allowed access to the outside, sheep or goats. So that's, and maybe Ms. Gauthier has something else to say. Also, Madam Chair, the loan is up to $10,000 per loan. So it is capped. That's on page 5, line 16.
Ms. Gauthier?
Madam Chair, specialty crops usually refer to vegetable farms, flowers. To the department from the immigrant and minority farming community had been from some Hmong vegetable farmers, some Somali goat producers, and some Latino chicken producers. And so in this initial part where it's a pilot, we are looking to work with those communities to help them expand their business and grow their business here in Minnesota. There actually is, Madam Chair, a shortage of goat meat in Minnesota right now.
Just a quick question. How do you determine ethnicity? You know, that if it's just four people who are immigrants, is there some special way that on the application, or how do you determine that?
Well, Madam Chair, if you look at page 5, line 5, the subdivision 3 eligibility, we took that language from some, at the recommendation of our HR department. It's a protected group there on line 5.8. Federal definition of a group consisting of women, minorities, and people who are handicapped.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, in Senator Magnus's committee, we had wonderful testimony from some ethnic groups and people that were very excited about this. It's not a lot of money. It's $10,000 per loan. When that money is gone, this is a pilot project. So it is something that just gives them the ability to establish their credit, to get going to, like I said, to buy some supplies and have a little bit of working capital and to move forward. So basically we're consolidating all these funds into the revolving loan fund, the RFA revolving loan fund, and working that way. But it was really a fun testimony in Senator Magnus's committee about the excitement in these communities about having the ability to get a loan and pay it back and be responsible.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Gauthier,
if I may, just for background information, most of the conventional lending tools that are available to farmers through the United States Department of Agriculture require a 3-year credit history. And sometimes these farmers who have come here as refugees or political asylees, for example, for countries in Africa or Southeast Asia, even though they have been successful farmers in those countries, there is no financial infrastructure in those countries, so they do not have a credit rating for the farming that they may have spent their whole life doing. So the problem is they can't access the programs that are available out there because they don't have 3 years of credit history. So this would enable them to start working towards that in small scale, equipment, a tool shed, seed and feed, that kind of thing, but establishing a credit history.
Thank you, Senator Bonoff, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions. When you said that this particular fund has been there since 2000 and hasn't been very well used, it raises the question, do we have other similar funds that we've approved over time that have kind of gone on in perpetuity and that are sitting on the books?
Ms. Gauthier.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, no, because these are revolving loan programs. So this was fairly unique because the appropriation in 2000 was only for agroforestry loans. We have another account that can go for many purposes and does routinely. It's constantly lended out on a situation where we said, let's put that money to work. In this economy, let's get that money out there and have it working for farmers in Minnesota. So it's still available for agroforestry loans, but it now also will be available for immigrant farmer loans, for the disaster recovery loans, the value-added product loans, and so on and so on, the other tools that we have in the Rural Finance Authority. To my knowledge, we do not have other funds that are revolving loan funds for which there are no applications, Madam Chair.
Then, Madam Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Ms. Gauthier, how will we let the community that is now could take advantage of this, how will we get the word out? I understand in the committee there seemed to be some excitement, but how will you spread the word over time to make sure that this fund is made use of?
Ms. Gauthier.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, well, many people in the community are already aware of it, that this bill is going through and watching it very closely. But we will work with the groups that have come to us. They approached the Commissioner of Agriculture, former State Senator Dave Fredrickson, about a year ago, and we worked with them for several months to help them identify what was the most important need that they had. And it really came down to this issue of being able to establish a credit history. So they're aware of this, and they were instrumental in putting this together. We're responding to the needs of this farming community, as we do with all farmers in Minnesota. So we will work with them and their networks and their email and all that and do the best job we possibly can to get the word out about this, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I think this looks like a very good program. I'm supportive of the bill, but I think it also raises a question about whether or not we have a process to sunset things automatically. You know, should in the future, when we're making these kinds of programs available, should we consider having sunsets on them so that it comes back before us and we revisit, is this still something that's worthwhile, something that we should be doing? Because it just begs the question, what else is out there that is ongoing and we don't have visibility towards it? So, you know, I don't know, Senator Rosen, that you'd want to put a sunset on this because it seems like it's a strong program, but I think as we look at bills in the Finance Committee, that's a question worth asking.
It's a good point, Senator Bonoff, last year when we were scratching around for dollars to balance our budget. And we did have a list, I don't know if this was one of them on there, of money that was available in various agencies. It may or may not have been. I don't think I saw this one because we were looking. But definitely, it makes you wonder if there's more out there that are not being used and are just kind of sitting on the shelf, repurposed, or put back into the general fund, certainly. So, Senator Rosen.
Thank you. And Senator Bob, that is it's a good question to look at some of these programs. And obviously, that's what the department did, is the agroforestry loan program, because of one application. And it was so tightly crafted to hybrid poplar. Mm-hmm. Poplar. And there were some other stipulations that made it unnecessary for or undoable for many of the people to apply for it. And so I applaud the department for looking at this and seeing the need and saying, you know, let's move this over. And again, you still can apply for the agroforestry loans, but it's in this revolving loan fund. And I'm not sure, Madam Chair, if those revolving loan funds are available or if you can – I suppose you can sunset them. I don't know. I don't really know. But this is a pilot program, too. And as I said, when the money is gone, it will be time for the department to reevaluate and see if it's something that we want to continue.
Of course, the money should – it could be used up this year, and then it would have to wait for repayment. But then there would be money available again.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, I mean, if you had 26 people take advantage of the full $10,000 right now, it would be gone in 1 year. Mm-hmm. Hopefully they won't all need $10,000 and you can do more loans than that.
Right.
Yep. Any other discussion, Senator Newman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Gauthier, I'm reading the bill, and specifically it talks about immigrant and minorities are going to be allowed to have access to a program for the purposes of financing the specialty crops and livestock. And the thought occurs to me is, why is it necessary to base the program on the basis of someone's ethnic background, as opposed to making a program available to all qualified applicants? I simply hold the belief that for the government to provide programs and funds and so forth to people on the basis of their ethnicity is wrong. You know, we should be taking care of all of the people, and it shouldn't be based on whether they are, you know, from a foreign country and have a different ethnic background than we do. So my question is why is it necessary to have a program that specifically targets folks on the basis of their ethnic background as opposed to simply allowing that group of people to participate in a program along with all other qualified applicants?
Ms. Gavier.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, thank you for that question. There are a number of things I can say to that, one of which is that as a group of agriculture in Minnesota, this is a relatively new and fast-growing, and that we have provided over the years a whole host of programs for farmers who were native-born in the United States in Minnesota to start farming, to transfer their farm to their children, to transfer their farm to other young people who want to farm who they do not know, to expand their farm, to improve their farm, to restructure their farm. And this is one class that has not, one group of people that has not had that kind of assistance from the government. And it's an issue, we think, of fairness, because this group of people does not have the capability to take advantage of the programs that are already out there for the farmers that are have been born and raised in this country, because they cannot get access to credit. This is something, Madam Chair, that's also been recognized by the United States Department of Agriculture. For most of their programs, they have a set-aside for women and minority farmers. So I guess our perspective is that the Minnesota Department of Agriculture should be here for all Minnesota farmers, and that if this is a unique problem that these farmers are having, then we want to try to meet that need, just as we have tried to meet over the years the needs of all kinds of other groups of farmers or individual farmers that have wanted to grow a farming business in Minnesota and expand the economy in Minnesota, expand the ag economy especially, and we've tried to respond to them as well. So we look at it as kind of an issue of fairness. These people are permanent residents of Minnesota. They're either citizens or on their way to becoming citizens of the state. So I guess that would be my answer, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
Madam Chair, just a follow-up comment. I appreciate your explanation. Excuse me. I'm not certain that I agree with you, and I would say that I didn't hear anything in the explanation that would tell me that the immigrant population that is trying to be addressed here could not be included in a program that is available to all citizens and all people that are legally here. It would simply, you know, if where they are coming from, the country they come from doesn't provide for them to establish a credit rating that would preclude them from participating in programs here in Minnesota in the United States, then I would say that the proper way to handle it would be to address that program and provide for them to be included and be able to participate. But again, I still believe that to make the qualifier for participation in a government loan on the basis of your ethnic background is a failed and fatally bad policy.
Any Madam other Chair. Questions on the bill? Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, and it's not based on just on ethnic background. It's also the disabled and the females and the protected class. So I do want to say that. And this is a loan that is going to go through the appropriate intermediary institutions that would handle this. And there's many other programs like that that are addressed, whether it's housing, whether it's
education that have been directed towards the minority class, be it disabled female or some ethnic background. So, like I said, this is a pilot project. It's to address this growing class of farmers and especially growers in the state that is increasing. They actually had, what was it, the 7th Annual Immigrant and Minority Farmer Conference this month, the 7th annual. So this has been around for 7 years now. And we're just trying to address some of the barriers that these immigrant farmers are facing.
Ms. Gauthier?
Madam Chair, yes, there were actually 300 farmers at that conference. So one other point, if I could, Madam Chair and Senator Newman, is that a lot of the existing programs out there were not established with this type of farming in mind, with small-scale farming that is not row crop or is not livestock. Mm-hmm. We believe that all types of farming are very important for Minnesota, and that the more we can grow our agriculture economy, the better it is for the state. So this is a new type of farming relatively in Minnesota, and we think it's important to help the economy grow.
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few comments in the testifiers talked about the members of the community out there that, and there are groups, there are groups of these folks that have organized groups to help them and to facilitate some of their concerns and needs. But we also did have testimony from the lending community also. I know Farm Credit's here, too, if they want to testify. But they testified fully in support of this program. And, it's something that we've given thought to. These small tracts of land along river bottoms and areas where you've got, 1, 2, 3 acres or something like this, close to all our community. We've got a lot of rivers and lakes in this state, and we have small areas of farm ground, and we need to recognize that the world's population is growing at 200,000 people a day. 200,000 people a day. Every 3.5 days, we're adding a state of South Dakota to the world's population. And we need to start thinking about how we're going to feed this amount of people in the world. Our food production is going to have to increase hugely in the future, and we're going to be asked to produce more and more and more. More vegetables, more corn, more soybeans, more pork, beef, poultry, goats, every year, and a lot more of it, on less land, using less inputs, energy, water, all this sort of thing. So we've got to start thinking about some innovative programs, and this is one of them, where you're looking at, not going out and farming at the scale that I, for example, farm, but looking at areas of land that we're going to have to utilize. If you go to some of the foreign countries, starting in the first trip I took in 1991 to Moscow, and if you, those of us a little gray in the hair, remember what happened then, the communist country fell apart, collapsed on itself. People were lined up for blocks in the streets to get loaves of bread. And I saw old ladies in the streets that had won World War II digging through piles of cabbage trying to find something to eat. And on the weekends, the people would take the subway there, cost about a fourth of a penny, take that out to the countryside, go to the little shack they had out there with their garden, and bring some food back for them to eat in the day. Little gardens like we're talking about here. That's what the people in the cities were doing. Can you imagine St. Paul and Minneapolis folks heading out to this, out to the countryside, to their little garden out there? But they had to do that to survive. They were starving.
And if you go to China, for example, you don't have to worry about MnDOT paying somebody a prevailing wage to go mow the road ditches down. They're growing wheat out there and barley and whatever you have. Other countries are recognizing this. So just a point to throw out that we are under increased demand for food. That demand is going to continue to skyrocket at an unbelievable level. Any ways we can do this to support food production and support, you know, looking at innovative ideas, I think is good.
Well,
so, Madam Chair, if no one else wants to testify, I would move Senate File 1315 to the floor.
Just a quick call for anyone else who might want to testify. I do want to get this bill moving. So if there's no other testimony, Senator Magnus has moved Senate File number 1713 be recommended to pass and be sent to general orders. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Rosen.
Good job.
Our next bill is Senate File 1260. It is Senator Cruz's bill. Welcome, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
If you would like to begin by explaining the bill briefly for us, and then we'll take a look at the fiscal note.
Madam Chair, if it would please you, I believe I do also have an amendment, if somebody could offer for me. I believe it's the A13 amendment. Do we have that on hand?
Senator Olson will offer the amendment, which is being distributed. Senator Cruz, do you want to explain this, please?
Very quickly, what the amendment does. The reason Senate File 1260 is before the committee today is we did have it on the Senate floor at the end of last session. It was Rule 72 back to committee. Essentially, the amendment does two things. It corrects an accidental deletion that occurred before it went to the Senate floor. And then secondly, it takes out Section 5 and Section 6 to make the Senate file congruent with the House file.
Are there any questions about the amendment? Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the removal of those sections, can you give more explanation? Usually the work of the previous committee is what is when the bill comes in is usually what we honor. And I've noticed recently in this session we're matching everything up with the House language, so maybe our committees aren't doing their work or what. I'm not sure.
And this was heard last year in front of local government, is that correct? And any other committee stops that it had previously? State government, and then it was in finance.
Finance as well, Madam Chair, correct.
Would you like to give an explanation of the deletion?
Certainly. A big portion of that deletion, Madam Chair and Senator Stump, have to do with Ramsey County. They were part of a group of people who approached me. The overall purpose of the bill is mandate relief for our local units of government, both at the municipal level and the county level. Ramsey County had approached me and asked me to take that out for the time being. They wanted an opportunity to work with some of the stakeholders and possibly present some other language. That's a large portion of it, and I think I would like to respect them in that. And the second part of that is the repealer request, the aggregate benefits, and That is very similar. What we're hoping is to have a little bit more time, work through some language where we can bring all the stakeholders together, and that's where some of those conversations happened in the House as well. So that, Madam Chair and Senator Stumpf, is the reason for those two deletions of those sections.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Higgins?
A couple of questions, Madam Chair. Is the appendix that's attached to the back all the things that are being repealed in the repealer section?
Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, yes, they are.
Okay. And then the other question, you're changing the what kind of newspaper various public – looks like just the delinquent real estate notice and list from a designated newspaper to a qualified newspaper. And I think I know what the difference is, but would you make sure that I'm not wandering off sideways in my brain?
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, I have Keith Carlson, who is the executive director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association, and I'd like to give him an opportunity to speak to that.
Welcome, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Inter-County Association, and I believe Senator Higgins understands this correctly. Under current law, technically, every county is required to annually bid just the publication of the delinquent tax lists. This removes that obligation. It doesn't prevent them from doing that if they want to go through that, but as long as they publish the list in the in a qualified newspaper, which you know is suitable for publishing any legal notices, they will have met the requirements of the law of publishing those lists.
Senator Higgins?
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Carlson, so using St. Paul as an example, the county could choose to publish it in the Pioneer Press as opposed to the St. Paul Legal Ledger. Is that the kind of the distinction?
Madam Chair, Senator, they certainly could do that, but basically the relief here is they don't have to go through the bidding process every year. They may choose to continue to do it with the Legal Ledger. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with what is St. Paul's legal or qualified newspaper right now, but they can essentially do whatever they want, continue to publish it where they are currently or continue to publish it where they publish their minutes, as long as it meets the definition of a qualified newspaper.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, for probably as long as I've been here in the legislature, we've talked about, it's getting to be a long time now, allowing the local governments to publish in more the community newspaper or even just online as opposed to these designated like the Legal Ledger and Finance and Commerce and those kinds of publications. And when I first saw this, I thought that was what was going to come forward, and instead it's this narrower piece. And maybe sometime after I leave here, somebody will figure out how to get that to happen.
But. Well, Senator Higgins, I think that the delinquent tax list is best publicized in a well-read newspaper because it is somewhat of a tool to get people to pay their property taxes so that they're not embarrassed by being listed on that list. So I maybe they just want some more flexibility about where they're going to publish it.
Right.
Are there any other questions? Senator Goodwin.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Cruz, I didn't have a copy of your amendments, so I didn't know if you had taken out the language on collective bargaining or if you'd left it in. And if you left it in, can you explain it to me? I don't understand what it's doing.
Madam Chair and Senator Goodwin, that was Section 6, and that was part of the language that we removed.
Thank you.
So, would someone like to move the A13 amendment?
I think I did.
Yes, Senator Olson did move the A13 amendment before our discussion. If there's no other questions, all in favor of the A13 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion is adopted. The amendment is the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Excuse me. And so then to the bill, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair and members, as I mentioned, the primary focus of this legislation is to provide mandate relief for our local units of government. It does it in a handful of ways. The first way is it reduces redundant publication requirements. The second way is it also reduces prescriptive annual binding requirement for tax delinquents that is unnecessary. If a county wants to solicit the annual bids, as much as Mr. Carlson referred to, we allow them some flexibility to do that. The third way is it reduces some reporting mandates concerning 3-2 beer licensure. The bill also repeals the ability of a county officer to petition the county board for additional funding for clerks in his or her office. The language is kind of outdated and for lack of a better term, meaningless, as the most of the budgets that they would be talking about come from the counties, and it's highly unlikely that they would overrule themselves. So that is there one other piece. It repeals a archaic seed and feed loan program where counties could provide financial assistance to farmers for seed and feed. The program has not been used since the 1930s during the Depression.
Senator Cruz, now we have a new one. Senator Rosen's bill is somewhat similar. Senator Stump.
Madam Chair, it is interesting reading through that seed and feed loan program where they're referencing purchasing seed and feed for their teams. Obviously, you know, when someone reads it, they think about athletic teams or town teams or something. But it's actually teams of horses. And then, and it talks about the number of horses or oxen owned by freeholders. And I think the most interesting thing is that these loans back then were given at a rate of 6%. Who would have ever dreamt that the interest rate would have been less than this was back in probably the early 1900s, that in the next century, interest rates would be lower than they were in the previous century. Yes.
That is interesting. That's an old statute. If there's another discussion on that part of it, let's go to the fiscal note quickly. Actually, there is a savings indicated here, which is always good to see. I don't know if you would like to explain where our savings are coming from, or Mr. Gustafson might want to share that with us. Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, members, the fiscal note shows a $14,000 savings in the miscellaneous special revenue fund. That fund, the state collects about $2.6 million in liquor license fees each year. We appropriate $153,000. Most of that flows to the general fund. We appropriate back $153,000 to the alcohol and gambling division to cover the costs of the collection. The 3-2 notification was part of their duties. They'll no longer be required to do it. And so the $14,000 savings just reflects savings of a quantification of effort that won't be required. There, as you can see, there's no reduction in the appropriation to the Division of Alcohol and Gambling. This just reflects that their workload would be reduced.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Turner. Any other questions about the bill? Senator Ingebertson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you go over that assumption for me, Mr. Turner, the 3-2 malt beverage licenses again? Is something under the assumptions on the fiscal note?
Mr. Turner?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebertson. Right now, municipalities have to inform the commissioner when they issue a 3-2 permit, and the commissioner has to maintain that list, and I guess this is I don't know what exactly is involved with it, although I think that Michelle Tuckner from the Division of Alcohol and Gambling is here, if you want her to explain the nuts and bolts of what the $14,000 would consist of.
It sounds like we're creating less work for them. So,
unless somebody else has got any questions, I understand it now. Thank you.
Are there any other questions on the bill? If not, Senator Olson will move that Senate File 1260 be recommended to pass and placed on general orders.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders. We have one final bill today, and it is Senator Ingebertson's bill, Senate File 1567.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1567 is before you here. It was a bill that came through my committee. It's basically I don't think the term is good, runoff, but nevertheless, it's a follow-up, I guess we would call it, from last year's permitting bill that, in a bipartisan fashion, the legislature and administration passed last year. What this does, we've heard from businesses across the state from House File 1 last year that that created jobs and streamlined the permitting process and was a real success. This year, again, we identified areas that can be streamlined, increased efficiencies, remove duplication, and overlap and bring it into the 21st century, the regulatory process in Minnesota that we all hear about so often. Senate File 1567 is a permitting efficiency bill endorsed and supported by the Minnesota Chamber. And as you can see, Mr. Quillis is with us, and he will help us through the bill here. Just recently, yesterday, by the way, the days are flying. Maybe it wasn't yesterday, the day before. I met with the governor, Commissioner Ozen, and Commissioner Landwehr in the governor's office to address the concerns the administration had regarding this bill. And I believe the amendment today will address their concerns and put together, again, a bipartisan bill that will create a better economic climate and provide jobs in Minnesota. As companies look to expand in this international economy, one of the areas they review besides taxes, energy costs, and workforce is how long it takes to obtain a permit for their expansion or building in a new facility. This legislation will alleviate many of the concerns in this area as well, ensuring our environment is protected for future generations. I believe this bill is a great positive step for Minnesota, and I seek the committee's support in passing it. Mr. Quillis from the Chamber will walk through the amendment.
So you would like to offer the
A6
amendment?
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I would like to amend the A6 amendment mostly just to fix a bad construction of a sentence. But line 1.14.
On the amendment or in the bill?
On the amendment. Okay. The original sentence says what entities are going to get information from our various boards. And in committee, we couldn't figure out why the Legislative Coordinating Commission was on there. And so this sentence is repairing that, but it didn't quite get the grammar right. So on line 1.14, before the opening quotation mark, insert semicolon. And after the ending semicolon, insert the word and. So it's just there are now two entities to give it to, the governor and the legislature, and so you need to put them together in a series that makes sense.
Okay.
And so it would
but
be.
But there's another one, and the revisor of statutes.
Hmm?
It's not just those two. There's a third one.
The revisor of statutes is being deleted.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. So it basically shall submit to the governor and the chairs of the House and of Representatives and Senate Committee. That's what I'm fixing.
Okay. There was an and inserted on line 1.16, but that's a different location. So this is all on line 1.14, line 28 of that bill. Yes. Okay. Senator Ingebertson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Monner, is it clear with you and puts the bill in order grammar-wise?
Maybe we could restate this.
Okay. Should I just tell you what the sentence is sure. going to read when I'm done? So if you go to 13.28 of the bill, that might be easier to look at. So we're deleting the Legislative Coordinating Commission semicolon. And what I'm doing is deleting the semicolon before that phrase and then inserting the word and. So it will say, shall submit to the governor and the chairs of the House of Representatives in the Senate.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, I think typically we leave the semicolon before the and at the end of a list. If you look, for example, in page 13, line 30 of the bill, you'll see at the end of that clause there. So I think you only need to delete one semicolon, which the amendment already does. You do need to insert the end before the chairs of the House of Representatives.
Mr. Bonner and Madam Chair, because there's only two, there isn't a list anymore. Because we're getting rid of the revisers as well in another line. So it's only the governor and the chairs. It isn't the governor, the chairs, and the revisor.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Bonner, to the amendment.
He's okay.
So, Madam Chair, just repeating quickly then, the Senator Higgins and I will offer to you that Senator Ingebretson can simply incorporate this in his amendment. On the A6 amendment, on page 1, line 14, after the opening quotation mark, insert a semicolon. And after the closing quotation mark, insert quote and close quote. That takes care of it.
Okay. And we will then have that incorporated when we adopt the amendment.
And then, Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins?
And Madam Chair, I'm wondering, Senator Ingebretson, on that same line, whether you'd be willing to put in the ranking minority members as well, chairs and ranking minority members.
Absolutely.
Then I would ask that be incorporated.
And I appreciate her pointing that out. She's done that several times throughout the bills, and that certainly should be there. Different bills, yes.
Okay. Now, to the amendment, Mr. Qualas, you are here to address that before we vote on it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Qualas. I am the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for allowing me the time today to testify in support of Senate File 1567. Senator Higgins and some of us who have been around for a while playing the role of Senator Frederickson this morning as we went through. And thank you, Senator Higgins. And I jokingly kidded Senator Higgins that I was going to refer to this as the Higgins Amendment because these are a number of recommendations, not all of hers, but a number of recommendations she put forth in the Senate Environment Committee that we have now fixed and have a fiscal implication, I think, for the bill. The first part was just a grammatical oversight where in Section 1 of the bill and 4 dealing with DNR permits, and we also do it subsequently with the PCA permits, we forgot to, on 1.19 and again on 4.5, delete substantially completed. We do that also, if you'll see, on 4.30 and also on 2.18, that's grammatical to just go back and get those words. And then subsequently, Madam Chair and members of the committee, if a permit does not meet a 150-day goal, there are two subsequent reports, one in February and one in August, where the PCA is obligated to tell in that report why the goal, one of the permit applications that have not met it, why the goal hasn't been met, what steps to be taken to complete the action, and the expected timeline to complete that action. Unfortunately, what happens is sometimes when a permit is returned to a project proposer, that is an internal discussion among the business, and it might be whether or not to do another risk analysis or some modeling So the PCA is not able to tell in that report how long it's going to take to meet the expected timeline or complete the application, because it is the business who is taking that decision internally. So they asked us to delete that, and we agreed, and hopefully that will save them some time in putting together the report. So that is basically where you see on for the PCA and the DNR. So one point on the amendment, 1.3 and 1.4, that gets rid of the complete steps taken to complete the action and the application. That's for the DNR. Lines 1.6 and 1.7 of the amendment, the A6 amendment, that's for the PCA. I hope that's clear. And then on page 5 of the bill, 1.18 of the amendment, we want to clarify at the agency's request that when a permit application professional is putting together the permit, there was concerns that, and you'll notice in the fiscal note, that that was going to trigger mandatory meetings with the project proposer and the agency. This is clarifying that it is upon the agency's request that those meetings would happen. Madam Chair, additionally, if we move down into that same section, 1.13 of the A6 amendment, the agency was concerned that they would not have enough information from the project proposer. So we are clarifying that other information as requested by the agency shall be submitted by the project proposer. So that helps alleviate some of their concerns. 1.14, 1.15, I think are grammatical that Senator Higgins pointed out. Those were oversights. I personally thought that we had corrected those in the Senate Environment Committee. We caught those in reviewing the bill and wanted to make sure that Senator Higgins and she is now corrected grammatically were taken care of. And then finally, Madam Chair, there is a report which is detailed at the end of the bill on page 14 that Senator Higgins pointed out she was concerned about some language. If you'll look at 14.1 to 14.5, we have eliminated that language and inserted an explanation of the mandatory worksheets and statements, and if there is any duplication not included in existing permit or federal law. So that will help, we think, focus the agencies, take away one of the concerns that Senator Higgins had. We hope make the report more concise and easier for the PCA to do. So that's the amendment, Madam Chair.
Any further discussion on the amendment? If not, all in favor of the A6 amendment as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. And now I think we should look at the fiscal note. We are getting a little short on time and want to make sure we cover that. It's my understanding that this amendment helped address some of those issues. And so now that we have the bill in the order that we want it, we can have an explanation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you'll look, if you have the fiscal note in front of you, on the bottom of page 9, the concern that the agency has and still has.
Mr. Qualls, perhaps we should have our fiscal analyst go through it.
Madam Chair, Dan Mueller, the fiscal analyst for the Environment Committee, I'll just briefly go through the fiscal note and the costs assigned to each agency, and then we can go back and address or look at some of the couple areas where are the main cost drivers. Let's jump to page 2 right away. This is the cost to the DNR. There's a small cost of $8,000, and that is mostly on, you'll see page on the bottom of page 3, the fiscal note. There's a process for reporting requirements that will cost roughly $8,000. And there's also a small cost savings actually in fiscal year 13 also on the bill of $4,000. So it's a net cost of about $4,000 in fiscal year 13. The next agency is PCA. And I'll point out first, if that starts on page 6 of the fiscal note, first of all, all the fiscal year 12 costs that are shown in the fiscal note should be out. The P, PCA and putting together fiscal note had a little bit of misunderstanding of what the effective date of most of the provisions in the bill were. So there will be no fiscal year 12 costs. There are a couple of main cost drivers, and we can probably jump to page 10 of the fiscal note. The first part, it shows, this is the part of the fiscal note that shows where that generates different FTEs. The first part just generates a 0.1 FTE for the first year. And so that's only it costs $10,000. The second part, the part that has a 0.75 FTE, is the additional employee, almost a full-time employee, to participate in the pre-application meetings. The biggest cost driver in the bill is actually on the bottom of page 10, you'll see there, is there's an appeals process in the bill. And I won't explain what the whole appeals process is. We can let the policy people explain that. But PCA is saying that's going to require an extra 2.25 FTEs to handle all the additional appeals that would happen in the bill. And there's some disagreement between the PCA and Mr. Quillis on whether that cost is going to be that high. So I'll just throw that out there. But that's part, and that is in the bill. It is on page 5, paragraph I. So that's lines 5.31. That's the main language right there that's driving the most cost that the PCA has identified right now. So I'll just put that out there. The rest of it, PCA, the other costs are pretty minor for a couple other parts in the bill. On page 11, you'll see their total FTE that they're saying is required of this bill is 3.18 FTEs. 2.25 of that is for the appeals process. So a majority of the costs for PCA is within the appeals process. The next agency we have is on page 12 is Employment and Economic Development. There's a $100,000 cost in the bill for assigning, they're called an Environmental Permits Coordinator. An amendment was put on in the Employment Economic Development Committee to allow them to assess the costs. So you'll see in the fiscal note there's a cost and a revenue coming in for that. So that part is paid for in the bill by allowing them to assess the costs. And that language in the bill is on page 9. You'll see in paragraph C, which is line 9.15, there's some language that was amended in that committee allowing them to assess costs and then appropriates it back through this special revenue fund. The last part of the bill is transportation. There's, a small cost. They're identifying $9,000 to report on. You'll see the last page of the fiscal note. MnDOT would have to submit a list of mandatory environmental assessment worksheets to the legislature. They're assuming a $9,000 cost for that. So that's a quick walkthrough of the fiscal note. And I'm sure Mr. Quillis has some other comments on it, if you have any other questions, I'll take them.
Other questions? Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, there are several places where it talks about the local impact, and mostly the comments seem to say darned if we know in some better language than that. But Mr. Mueller, is there any way to actually get a local government cost impact as we're doing these fiscal notes? I mean, each department talked about the local effect. And
Mr. Mueller?
How would we do that?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, the fiscal notes, when they can assign a specific cost to local governments, they do it. A lot of times you'll see just what you're seeing in this fiscal note. It's hard for them to do a really good estimate of that without doing a lot of probably surveying of different local governments. So where there is a definite, where they can assign a definite cost to local government, they do, but for the most part, if it's a policy item that's really hard to quantify at each local level, they usually make a note that's saying it's difficult to estimate.
We do have a process to request a local impact note. It takes quite a while to prepare because of the efforts to survey various entities. I don't think one was specifically requested on this, perhaps. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Higgins, I certainly understand what you're asking there and wondering about. And I guess I'm just kind of thinking on the fly here that knowing that the AMC is monitoring these things as well as cities and whatnot, they certainly would come forth with some concerns. I have not been approached by that on this particular area. So I don't know if the chamber has been contacted by them about any local impact. So usually they're pretty on top of it.
Okay. And then,
Senator
Madam
Higgins?
Chair, is everything paid for in this bill internally?
It appears not. But there's debate about whether or not the appeals process will be requiring as much staffing as has been indicated. And I think one of the amendment took care of some of these issues, correct? But there is still some cost tied to the bill. And I don't know if someone would like to address that, Senator Olson.
If you follow up with yours, and then I'm not addressing that. What I wanted to know was essentially, what do you anticipate is either a range based on the disagreements of what the cost is of the cumulative fiscal note from the cumulative departments from this bill, and whether you're keeping track of any of some of our other provisions that may be saving money, that as to whether this will have a negative or positive or revenue neutral when we get done with everything.
Well, we try to do some of that, although we haven't had too many bills come through yet. But certainly we have seen bills with savings in them as well. And not necessarily for these departments, but some of them may have been for that as well. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Madam Chair, if the committee would like, I could have the representative from PCA come up and talk about the appeals process, where we're having a little bit of an issue with regards to how many and exactly what takes place.
Welcome.
I think that addresses the biggest part of the fiscal note.
Chairman, committee members, my name is Kirk Adelk. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And thank you for the opportunity to testify on the fiscal note. I'd just like to back up a little bit. There is also some question about the cost that's directly linked to the pre-application meetings. The amendment does make some changes. However, it's still before the amendment, it was the number of meetings is based upon the agency's request, and after the amendment, it's based on the same assumptions. It's just changed where it is in the sentence. So we don't believe those numbers change, so those costs are still there. Specifically to the court case, that deals with the permit professional, and on page 5, that starts coming into effect on 5.25 through 5.30. If the MPCA turns back an application that's done by a permit professional, if they believe for some reason the agency erred or they were wronged in that, they can bring the issue to court. Right now, on line 5.27, there's the standard there. There's a clearly erroneous that there is an error in our judgment. A lot of times where we could see this as an example of occurring is over something such as air modeling, where there is some difference of opinions between agencies and consultants at times. And what happens is if we return something saying that the items needed for the modeling protocol or what we expect to be done during the process is not there, it's more a disagreement of it's not a clearly erroneous necessarily, but just a disagreement on what's there we could easily see this end up in court. We've had cases where there was a dispute over some of those key concepts on what is within the jurisdiction of the agency. For instance, with the Metro Transit on the potential to omit, where it was over a $2,500 APO, which was taken to the administrative law judge and spent a number of time over such issues. Those are the classic type of situations where we see where there may be disagreement, and that opening it up now to court action, there is the high probability we see about 9 of these cases going to the courts as a result, which will slow down permitting.
Are there further questions? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going to page 5, the section of the statutes you were just referring to, it's my understanding that currently what would happen is the if there was a dispute, the matter would ultimately go to an ALJ. They would make a recommendation. It comes back to the PCA. The PCA then makes a final decision. That final decision is then appealable to the Court of Appeals. Am I correct on that?
Mr. Kodalka?
Chair and committee members, I believe that is correct on the permit once we put something out there. This is a much earlier step in the process where we're just talking about what information is coming in the application. We check for the administrative stuff. Is the check there, the signature there, all the forms there, and if the data is there. This is something that's fairly new, this 30 days, and the point there where we're turning back applications if they're not complete. I don't think at this point we've had a case that has gone that route. I'm not sure. I would need to check with our legal folks to see if that is an option in this early part of the permitting process. You're correct. In the latter half of the permitting process, things could be appealed to an administrative law judge.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
You had made reference that there's, you know, a probability or a possibility of these matters going into court, and what I'm trying to figure out is whether or not you are talking about these matters going into district court, or are you talking about appeals to the Court of Appeals?
Mr. Kodalka.
Chair and committee members, the bill here allows for a decision to go to the Court of Appeals dealing with the permit application, which would be different than a permit on the later half going to the AL administrative law judge or the Court of Appeals. This is a different section. We anticipate more of these situations where there are some disputes on the specifics of what's needed in the application to deem it complete. It's just another opportunity for this to go into litigation, which we see, given there's a new opportunity, there will be additional folks taking that opportunity, 9 we estimate a year.
Madam Chair, let me try it this way. Under the terms of this bill, do you anticipate litigation in the district court?
Mr. Kodalka or
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, I'm going to go back to some painful memories last year, and I'm sure you were there in the Senate Judiciary Committee, where in House File 1, Senate File 42, that was subsequently signed by the governor, there was what we perceived as an oversight on where environmental review decisions were reviewed by a district court and then went to the Court of Appeals, and what happened to permit applications when they were appealed. They made a stop at district court and went to the Court of Appeals. Last year in House File 1, Senate File 42, we eliminated that district court stop. So now appeals for environmental review decisions as well as permits go right to the Court of Appeals. There's no stop in the district court.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That answers my question.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I still have some questions about this substantially complete permit application.
Senator Higgins.
Phrases that we,
I know that that's more of a policy issue,
yeah,
perhaps.
I know, but I'm going to try and ask about some money attached to it.
Okay.
I'm trying, Madam Chair.
Okay, because we are already over time. And
oh, we are? Okay. I'm just wondering if there now it's, you know, or you know, the language that we passed last year, the 150 days goes with the substantially completed permit applications, and now we're taking that language away, so it could be a very minimal sort of application that comes in, and I was going to ask what kind of effect the department thinks that would have on
on the work that they do. Now, the ones that are just very minimally filled out and turned in aren't part of this, but now they will be. And so I'm trying to figure out, is that a lot of applications? Is that just a few applications? How is that going to affect the workload of the departments? See, I tried.
See, Senator Higgins, I read that just differently because I figured if we took out substantially completed, it had to be completed. You couldn't come in with a partial one, but I would like to know what the
effect, which RID actually is.
Senator Ingebrigtsen or someone who might have an answer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Higgins, right now, and I'll try and grab him real quick, what we're trying to do is we're trying to clarify when the 150-day clock starts on the goal that the PCA has been doing a very good job, and Mr. Kadelka will tell you that they're getting close to 90%. Mm-hmm. There are still, and I can pull the numbers up, I think the last quarterly report showed 36 applications that were returned to the applicant because they weren't substantially complete. And then it gets pointed out in the report. What we're trying to do, instead of saying I'm handing in my application, they're saying, no, it's not substantially complete. The clock doesn't start. And so we're saying when we put the application in, the clock starts. And in the subsequent two reports that they have to do on February 1st and August 1st, just note that if it's incomplete, say, and they have it down, whether it lacks signatures, whether it doesn't have the application fee, whether or not the applicant didn't submit sufficient forms, that's all we're trying to say. It'll be in the report of the 125 applications returned, it would be what's known as a number four, the project proposer's fault.
So, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and Mr. Quillis, this is about the report, not about other actions at the agencies.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, what we're trying to do is just say when the clock starts.
Mr. Kadelka.
Chair and committee members, we do anticipate that it will affect the timeliness of permits prior to this change. As the senator mentioned, applications will come in half done or not fully complete, the agency would have to do a lot of nagging on the permittee or project proposer to get them to get where we need the permit and the information for us to move. The advances in House File 1, which were great advances, within 30 days, we have to let them know if it's something we can have start working on. Taking that away, what we've seen are better applications coming in as a process, which speeds up permitting timeline along the line because we have everything we need to keep working instead of nagging folks. This will go us back to the old system where we will get half-complete applications sitting in here, and people will just assume that the agency is the one that's going to fix them and make them right, and that will take more time as we continue to go back to the consultant to nag them to get the information we need.
Senator Higgins.
What we just heard might be some unintended consequences of what Mr. Quillis is trying to do and what actually might be affecting the agency. And so may I suggest you all keep working and seeing if there's something else that we can do. And on the floor, maybe there'll be a fix that both the departments and businesses can work with. It would be a good thing if you could.
I promise I won't put the word nagging in there, though.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me, you know, I know my memory doesn't always serve me right, but I think it was last year, and possibly in the discussions around the bill that passed last year, that an agency said, you know, that they had gone to the process of holding pre-application meetings and that it had gone a long way to improving the applications that were put in so that there didn't have to be a lot of the stuff that we're now wrangling about in terms of timing. And was that the case, or is this a new feature of the pre-application meeting? But it would seem to me that the pre-application meeting would, if it's well handled and communicated, that it should improve that process afterwards and hopefully not lead to so many of the appeals or the back and forth that I think you're attempting to eliminate in this whole effort.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson,
Mr.
correct.
Mr. Quillis.
Pardon me?
Correct.
Okay.
Exactly.
Had the agency already implemented some pre-application meetings or tried this, or am I dreaming about that? part, or it might have been a different agency, that you're trying to interject that idea. But it looks like the fiscal note reflects an increasing cost for the pre-application meetings, plus some cost drivers that are assumed that nothing really improves in terms of the application that really should be the aim of the pre-application meeting.
Mr. Kudelka, about the pre-application meetings?
Chair and committee members, the senator is correct. We do ask proposers early on in their project to come to us to help create a timeline, let them know what expectations they have through the permitting process, and we can give them advice where we see someone's made a better widget, give them advice to improve or maybe get out of permits. Currently, right now, the number of pre-application meetings we're doing is 108 a year. We anticipate with the change in this bill, those numbers and the use of the permit professional that's in the bill, that would increase to 500. So there would be a number of additional meetings. I believe the senator is correct, and we can look into it. There may have some improvements on the backside, too. They're just not quantified here. We can look into.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, back to the financial end of this. I notice we have fees that are going to cover some parts of it, but is it possible that the applicant's fees could be raised a little bit to cover some more of it if there is indeed a new process that's going to take more time but maybe save time for the applicant? I'm just trying to figure out how we can cover the agency's costs maybe a little bit more if indeed it takes them more time but then saves the applicant time.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm certainly committed to working with this. As you can see, this certainly is a work in progress here. I know the House bill is traveling along, and Mr. Quillis is telling me there's an awful lot of things going on as well. So if we're looking at raising fees, I guess we can certainly look at that, and we'll maybe Mr. Quillis wants to comment on that because he's definitely in the weeds on this.
Mr. Quillis?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're still negotiating with the agency. As Mr. Kudelka pointed out, under their expedited rulemaking right now, they are pre-application meetings. There's 108, and we think that the number that they've said increasing 392 to have a total of 500 pre-application meetings under the proposed permit application professional might be a little on the high end for the activation of the permit application professional. That qualification for that, it would have to be allowed under federal law. The project proposer would have to decide to do that. The applicant would also have to abide by all the PCA rules. There's the appeals process that Senator Newman talked about. We think before you even, we're not sure how many project proposers, we estimated there would be 8 to 10 folks maybe going, not 392. So we're working on that as we go through. And then that subsequent how many pre-application meetings would go through was also driving the 9 appeals process that Mr. Kudelka pointed out. So if we can work on the 392, I think we alleviate also the number of appeals processes along the way. And we're going to keep having those conversations with the agencies as we move through the process.
So, Senator Ingebrigtsen, did you want to keep the bill here as you work on it, or do you want to work on it between here and the floor?
I think between here and the floor would be fine. That's how I'd sooner do it. So not to keep it here.
Because I'd like to see some of the difference worked out yet and determined. And it is hard to charge a flat fee to everyone if some people don't even, they come in with such a good application that they don't need to have any pre-application meetings. So I'm just trying to figure out if that becomes the case, if there could be an extra fee for those folks who use that service, whereas the other ones may not need it because they have done so many of these that they have everything they need. So I don't know how we could do that, but I want to, I just want to make sure that the process is expedited, and that I know that's what the gist of this whole bill is about, and so we want to keep it moving.
In talking with my two compadres here, there's some dollars. Madam Chair, I'm sorry. In the environmental fund that we can look at, we're not prepared to look at those numbers right now, but there might be some dollars there.
Senator Higgins?
As long as it's the finance piece of it is still in flux, maybe the wisest thing to do is to just keep it here And when they're ready to bring back the way to pay for the bill, then we just take it up and assess it at that point. I like your idea. Just keep it here.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're not doing our jobs.
Right. Senator Ingebrigtsen, I kind of feel that way, that we probably should just lay it over and revisit it as early as you possibly want. We will put it on the agenda. And if it's our next meeting, that's when it will be, just so we can iron this out. I wouldn't mind having the agency eat some of this cost. I just want to make sure that it's not more than they can bite off, or if they can come back and tell us we can reprioritize in another area and we can do this without an additional cost. That would be the best news of all, because we are looking for reprioritization, of course, and we know that this is very important. It's important for our business development in our state, and we want to keep these projects moving forward and not hold them up and send people running elsewhere because we make it too difficult. And so, you know, it's a high priority, and we want to take care of it. And I would ask the department to look at ways where they might be able to reprioritize and maybe adjust this fiscal note some too, working with Senator Ingebrigtsen and Mr. Qualis. So with that, will they Senate file? Did we vote on the amendment?
I don't think
we did.
Yes.
We did vote on the amendment, yes. We'll lay the Senate file on the table until our next meeting, if we're ready for it, 1567. With that, no other business is before us, and the meeting is adjourned.